This special update of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com, Audible, and Squarespace. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Back in January, just before we released the last episode of Season 2 of Undisclosed, covering the Joey Watkins case, Joey's attorneys with the Georgia Innocence Project filed a habeas on his behalf for the Walker County Superior Court. Unfortunately, we don't have much in the way of updates for you there yet. His habeas is still pending and awaiting hearing on the claims set out in his habeas petition. But in addition to Joey's pending case, there's another litigation that's been ongoing for the past several months, and that's the case of Undisclosed v. State. It started last year when Floyd County denied a request to copy the trial tapes from Joey's trial, and also the pretrial hearings. So, after the state said no, we couldn't have trial audio, we got in touch with Kaplan Cobb, a law firm in Atlanta, and they agreed to represent us in seeking the tapes. The attorneys at Kaplan Cobb are actually no strangers to the wrongful conviction legal podcasting world. Partner Mike Kaplan actually represented Justin Chapman in his habeas petition. Justin, you might remember, was the subject of the first season of the Breakdown podcast from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His conviction was overturned for multiple Brady violations back in 2015, and now the attorneys at Kaplan Cobb would be helping Undisclosed in obtaining access to the Watkins court tapes for our podcast. So Kaplan Cobb filed a motion with the court on Undisclosed behalf pursuant to Uniform Superior Court Rule 21, which provides, all court records are public and are to be available for public inspection unless public access is limited by law or by the procedure set forth below. That motion was heard by Judge Sparks, who had only recently become a judge in Floyd County, about a month before the motion was filed. He denied our motion, stating that Undisclosed could, if we wanted to, come to the court and listen to the trial tapes for a $200 a day fee, but we are prohibited from making any copies whatsoever, which, as a podcast, didn't really work for us. So a discretionary appeal was filed, and the Georgia Supreme Court granted it and agreed to hear oral arguments in this case. A briefing schedule was issued, and both Undisclosed and the Floyd County DA, on behalf of the state of Georgia, submitted briefs addressing two questions posed by the Supreme Court. First, whether a motion filed pursuant to Uniform Superior Court Rule 21 is the proper vehicle for a non-party to access and copy judicial records, and second, whether the Superior Court of Floyd County improperly prohibited Undisclosed from copying judicial records. The court also scheduled oral arguments for May 1st.
My name is James Cobb. I am a partner with Kaplan Cobb in Atlanta, represent Undisclosed in the Supreme Court appeal that's going to be heard next week. And we're here today to do a moot argument to get ready.
I'm Sarah Brewerton-Palmer, also working on this case with James, helping him prep for his argument on Monday.
Sarah's the brains in this operation.
I don't know about that.
On the Friday before the oral arguments, I met with James and Sarah, and also Mike Kaplan, at Kaplan Cobb's offices in Midtown Atlanta, to talk about the upcoming arguments and what we could expect.
So we are the second up on a calendar of three cases in the courtroom. We have to be there for the entire time that all the cases are being argued. After the first case goes, they'll call our case, and because we are the appellant, which is the term for the party that filed the appeal, we will be the first to argue. We'll have 20 minutes to make an argument. You're at a lectern with a bench of nine justices in front of you. It's a little comical because our Supreme Court only recently added two more members. It used to be a seven-member court, now it's nine, but they haven't adjusted the bench. So they're all kind of crowded around like a big family around a small table. And you give the argument, you go through your points, but our court tends to be what we call, what lawyers call a hot bench, where they'll ask a lot of questions. And it's unlikely that while I'll be prepared to speak for 20 minutes, if no one asks me a question, that's highly unlikely. I might get questions literally right out of the gate. There's a clock that counts down your time. It's responsibility of the lawyer to manage your time. There are some lights that tell you green, yellow, red. And if I want to reserve any time to rebut the other side's argument, I have an opportunity to do that. I've got to reserve that time, but then I have to abide by my reservation. I've had that happen before in this court and others where you intend to reserve time, but then there are just so many questions and you lose track of time when you're up there that you end up not, and that's unfortunate. And then we'll be done and we'll wait some period of time It could be quickly because they've thought about these issues in connection with the Marchand case, or it could be some period of time. There is a limit on how long the court can wait before it issues a ruling. So it's not going to be indefinite. We're not going to be waiting for 2 years, but it could be some months before we hear the results of the case.
Yeah. Back when last year, when we were first talking about this, remember y'all saying that Eastern AG would be handling this, or that, you know, the state of Georgia would have the position. And instead, we've got Floyd County itself filing the briefs and arguing.
If we had sued the judge, like happened in the Marchand case, we would have gotten the AG, because their authority includes the AG's office. Its authority includes representing judges in mandamus proceedings. Whereas, since we filed the case in the underlying criminal action, where the district attorney has responsibility for prosecuting, that's why we have the DA representing the state as opposed to the attorney general representing the state.
Okay.
But normally, you raise an interesting point, because under the Georgia Constitution, I believe, the state and the attorney general has the obligation to represent the state in murder cases before the Georgia Supreme Court. And I am frankly surprised that the attorney general did not take this case, because typically the district attorney's offices do not handle appeals before the Supreme Court that involve murder cases. Now, what I suspect they reasoned is that this is not an underlying appeal of the murder conviction, but is instead a collateral matter. But it is a matter of great importance, you know, not just to Undisclosed and to those who are, you know, listening to Undisclosed podcasts, but also, I think, to the state in general. So it's somewhat surprising that the attorney general did not enter an appearance.
It's troubling that Floyd County DA can make an argument that theoretically could win and thereby limit the right of the entire state of Georgia to copy court records.
One of the ironies that we were talking about this argument is that during the argument, the court will be live streaming the argument online, which can certainly be recorded. And our court is one of the most, I would say, forward-looking in the nation as far as its open access, our Supreme Court.
And their rules allow you to just walk up and plug into their audio feed to record the goings-on if you want to. Any news organization or anybody can walk up to the clerk in the middle of the argument.
It's interesting. There's been a lot of debate in this state about the appropriateness of sealing records, the importance of open and transparent courts. And this issue tends to come up in those two contexts, one where some judge has limited access to the courtroom or to a document, and the other is where a private party says, look, I've got to file this document in the court, but this document contains some piece of information that I need to keep private. And in that instance, the private party will file a motion to affirmatively seal. And they've got to engage in basically the same analysis. They've got to overcome the presumption of accessibility to get that sealing.
I'm curious to see who's going to show up on their side to argue on Monday.
They've told us that it's going to be John McClellan, so not Lee.
Oh, Joey's old attorney.
Really? I didn't know that.
He represented Joey before the murder trial.
The whole family.
Wow.
For years.
John McClellan represented Joey Watkins.
And in criminal
matters.
You know, little misdemeanors.
No kidding. That is fascinating.
Hmm. Yeah. And so in these briefs, which yours are fantastic, by the way. And it's not just because the other side's briefs makes you look awesome.
Well, we tried.
But this is kind of crazy, right? What they've been writing in the briefs?
It is. Their arguments are very aggressive with respect to what the government's rights are, the court's rights are, in this type of circumstance. If they were to win, these state of Georgia law. Georgia law has been since 1992 that a court reporter's official audio recording is a court record that's subject to the common law right of access, and that would be reversed 180 degrees.
What's kind of horrifying is the pure scope of what they're trying. I mean, I don't think there's a good chance the court's going to, like, give an expansive ruling against us, but if they did and gave Floyd County what they've been asking for, that would take away the right to copy any kind of court record.
So they're making two arguments. And the analysis the court's going to engage in is a two-step analysis. At step one, the court has to make a threshold determination of whether whatever material we're dealing with is, here are the audio recordings, they've got to analyze whether that is a, quote, court record, unquote, which is a term of art under Georgia law. If the answer to question one is yes, then the court goes to question two. And the way this works under the law is there is a presumption of accessibility. What that means is when we go into court, we make arguments that our clients are entitled to certain things. Normally, I've got a burden of proof to show legally and factually that we're entitled to whatever relief we're seeking. But when I have a presumption in my favor, the burden flips, and the court will presume that I get what I want, and the other side now has the burden to show me why I shouldn't be allowed to have it. And so that's what would happen in step two. If the court says, this is a court record, then in step two, it's the state's obligation to come in and explain why there are, you know, compelling state interests or privacy concerns or something that outweigh my right as a member of the public to get access to these records. If they win, two things could happen. The first is the definition of what's a court record in Georgia will change. Currently, Georgia law says that a court reporter's audio tape is a court record. So that will change. And it'll just take these audio tapes off the table. You'll never get to step two of the analysis. But the other thing that will happen if they win is it'll remove a part of what I call the basket of rights. When you are invoking your right of access, you get some rights that are part of that basket. You get the right to look at the documents. You get the right to copy documents. And they are, in essence, asking the court to take one of those rights out of the basket, the right to copy. So we could all go look at them, but we couldn't take pictures of them, put them on a photocopy machine, and go out and use them as examples when, you know, advocating for social issues or trying to convince people that government's not doing what it should be doing.
Yeah. What I found interesting is that it's almost like their arguments here in the trial tape stuff is like sort of parallel to their arguments against Joey. They don't want to be forced to have anything be seen. They don't want to have anything ever reopened to look at it again. They want it quick, final, and not subject to review.
The question that always comes to my mind as I've thought about this case over the last couple of weeks is why? Why does the government care about whether we have a copy of the audio recording?
Am I right that they've never made an explanation of that?
Not on the briefing, no.
I mean, you're correct. They have not made that explanation. And the court, in its order denying us the ability to copy, didn't give any explanation for why we shouldn't be allowed to copy.
It's all about whether you have a right to or not.
Yeah.
I thought they were going to try and pull some, like, oh, the poor witnesses are going to have their names drug through the mud if they're allowed to have their voices played. I don't know.
In some ways, that would make more sense because that is the traditional way you talk about these issues once you get past step one. And there's such clear law in Georgia that we're past step one on these types of records.
Yeah. Well, we know, I mean, in reality, we know why they denied access, because they told you, Claire, that you were going to use it for a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I mean, that. Of all justifications, that's one of the few that would never be approved by a court.
And what's crazy is it's not just undisclosed, it doesn't have access now. It is the defendant. The guy who is spending life in prison has no right to hear audio from his trial because...
he can't be there to inspect, right? He can't move from where he is.
Hey, it's Dennis, producer of Undisclosed. I want to talk to you about how important Stamps.com is for helping us to run our small business. Small business owners can attest to this. You spend a lot of time sending mail. That might mean paying bills or sending payment invoices, or in our case, shipping equipment around the country to make sure that we can record great podcasts. Now, you think we'd be frustrated about spending too much time at the post office mailing out all this stuff, but far from it. We don't go to the post office at all, and that's all because of Stamps.com. If you run a small business like we do, then do what we did, and that's sign up for Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail any letter, any package using just your computer and printer, and the mailman picks it up. Click, print, mail, and you are done. Not only that, but Stamps.com will send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. It's easy to sign up, too. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Undisclosed uses Stamps.com because, as a small business, we just don't have time not to use it. And right now, you too can enjoy the stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com. Enter Undisclosed. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
Georgia treats judicial records differently from other forms of government records. It's the Open Records Act, the ORA, which governs access to records for most other state agencies. However, it doesn't apply to the judicial branch.
The ORA, the Open Records Act, is an interesting example because it's generally viewed not to apply to the judiciary, but it embodies the state's policy in favor of access to government records. It's a strong policy in favor of transparency and open government. And the Open Records Act certainly includes a right to copy. It says that in the statute. There's something odd in my mind about a result in which you could be entitled to go copy any other government agency's records, but the judiciary could render a decision applicable to itself that says you can't copy our records. I think that's the least likely outcome. I don't think they're going to use this case as a vehicle to say you don't have a right to copy, because we were given the right to copy a different court record, the transcript. And so I think at most what they'll say is you don't have a right to access the audio tapes that were used to create the transcript, and they'll just ignore the copy issue entirely, because that's the only way that they can avoid a significant dismembering of the right of access by saying it doesn't include a right to copy. I don't think they want to do that.
Isn't there some flowery court language somewhere, and one of the opinions says like the reason that the courts aren't part of the Open Records Act is because they can be trusted to be more honorable and noble?
We manage our own files and records, and that's the idea, right, is that the judiciary can be trusted to do it on its own, and so we'll see what happens.
While there are a number of significant constitutional issues that our request for the trial tapes touches on, such as the right of access to court proceedings under the First and Sixth Amendments, what we're seeking are court records, and for that, the constitutional basis is not as solid.
But set of rights two is the access to court records. And there's significant disagreement among the courts about whether that is constitutional in nature. So strategically, our better option here is we don't need to go there to win, and it would open up a can of worms that would get us well off our path to victory.
Very distracting.
Yeah, and at least one of the justices we know from a prior oral argument is 100% convinced that there is no constitutional right of access to documents. And there's a lot of case law to back that up, including a Supreme Court decision from the 60s involving the Nixon-Watergate tapes that can be read to at least implicitly say there's no constitutional right of access to court documents.
Unsurprisingly, Undisclosed is not the first litigant to seek access to trial audio in Georgia. In fact, just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court of Georgia heard another case presenting a similar issue in a suit brought by a law firm seeking recorded remarks from a judge.
So this arose out of a couple criminal cases being handled by the Merchant Law Firm, which is a criminal defense firm in Marietta. And my best understanding is that one of the partners was arguing in front of a judge up in Cobb County, and he was disrespectful to her in some way. And they wanted an audio copy of what occurred in those hearings because certain things weren't reflected in the transcript. I don't think the transcript was necessarily inaccurate, but it was more like a tone of voice issue, something like that. So they requested access to copy the tapes from a court reporter who said no. And the judge in the underlying criminal cases on his own issued an order saying you can listen to them and let me know if there's any inaccuracies in the transcript, but you can't copy it. So they filed a separate civil suit seeking a writ of mandamus, which is essentially a way to get somebody to do something that they have to do, asking another judge in that same court to order the first judge to let them copy the tapes under Rule 21. Since it was a new case, it took a little longer to get up to the Supreme Court, so they filed that in 2015, and it was briefed up and orally argued in February of this year. And it essentially raises the same question of whether Rule 21 includes this right to copy, because the trial judge had originally done the same thing that happened to us here, and it's also happened in a couple other cases around Georgia. I think there's four in the last 2 years that have given a party a right to, or a non-party in this case, a right to listen to a tape, but not a right to copy. So this question's been kind of bubbling up for a while now.
So that's the background on our lawsuit, but I was also at Kaplan Cobb that day for James's moot. A moot is sort of a practice argument. Before you go before the Court of Appeals, you go before a room of friends and colleagues who pretend to be judges and who typically try and find a way to trip you up by asking harder and harder questions until they find one that you can't answer. That way, you'll know what parts of your argument you need to focus on when preparing for the real thing. Here's James at the moot at Kaplan Cobb on Friday before Monday's oral arguments, fielding questions from the moot panel about what law actually grants Undisclosed the right to request the trial tapes. Does this right originate in the common law, which has traditionally recognized the right to access and copy court records? Or does it instead come from Georgia's Uniform Superior Court rules, which, at Rule 21, provide for this right to access court records, although it uses the word inspect alone and not the word inspect and copy, as is found in the Open Records Act.
The right to copy doesn't turn on the type of record that's being copied, right? The right to copy turns on the concept that...
I understand that there's a common law right to copy. There is a common law right to inspect. And Rule 21 says you have the right to inspect. It doesn't use the word copy. You're not saying those two words are the same, are you?
They could be. I don't think this court needs to reach that decision. This court could rule in our favor without ever interpreting Rule 21. And there are two ways it could do that. One is to conclude that the common law right...
Before we get quite that far, though, you know, I went back in the record to the motion that you filed below, and it doesn't make any reference to a common law right of access or a common law right to copy. It does reference Rule 21, says this motion is being filed pursuant to Rule 21. So, you know, what vehicle have you presented these common law arguments before now?
In our motion, we referenced Rule 21 and Green versus Drennan. Rule 21 embodies the right to access, and there are a number of decisions from this court, the Long decision, the In re Atlanta Journal Constitution decision, that say that the adoption of Rule 21 is a preservation of the preexisting common law right. So our...
Which common law right?
The common law right of access. Now, those courts don't go on to delineate all the components of that common law right of access, but the way courts discuss this right is at a high level. They refer to the common law right of access, and then necessarily wrapped up in that, if you look to decisions about the common law, includes a right, necessarily wrapped up in that right of access is a right to copy. To go back to your question, Justice Siever, the motion referred to Rule 21 and Green. If you read, and we attached a copy of Green to the motion, if you read the Green decision, there is language in there that equates, essentially. It says that Rule 21 is a preservation of the traditional right of access. The traditional right of access is the right of access that's existed for hundreds of years, back to the 1600s, even before this country was formed. So while we didn't, in the text of the motion, say, pursuant to the common law right of access as it's existed since the 1600s and pursuant to Rule 21, we request access to these records, we did cite authority that recognizes that common law right. And that's more than enough for us to say today that in coming into court and standing here before you on this day, we are proceeding under the common law right of access.
Also, full disclosure, I apologize, but you can blame me for that writing noise you're hearing. Apparently, I was close enough to the mic where I could pick up my note-taking. Anyway, another big issue before the court is the distinction between inspect and copy. The court rules only use the word inspect, like I said. So does that mean that no one in Georgia has any right to ever actually copy judicial records? Just the right to come to the court and look at them there?
Justice Ramachandrapa, your question about the word inspect, I think that's an important question because there are two ways that this court could rule in our favor without creating a precedent that expands the word inspect to mean inspect and copy. I frankly think it would be perfectly acceptable to interpret Rule 21's use of the word inspect to mean inspect and copy, but that's not necessary. The first way this court could rule in our favor is by recognizing that the common law right of access existed before Rule 21 was adopted. And then by second, recognizing that the adoption of Rule 21 did not change in any way that common law right. How do we know it didn't change the common law right? The rules say that. Rule 1, which is at the very beginning, it's in the preamble to the Uniform Superior Court rules, says expressly that these rules do not supersede substantive law, and in the event of conflict, they shall yield to substantive law.
If Rule 21 was just adopting the common law right to access, why doesn't it say you have a right to access? Instead, it says you have a right to inspect.
I have no idea. If I was writing that rule today, I would write it as the right to access. But I don't think it needs to, because there are at least three decisions from this court that recognize Rule 21 as being a preservation of the pre-existing traditional right of access, which I don't think anyone in this courtroom, at least on this side of the bench, disputes. The traditional right of access includes a right to copy.
One complication that Kaplan Kavis faced in preparing for arguments is that there's just not all that much case law out there in Georgia addressing the question of what court records are and what the right to inspect them means, which is likely why, at least in part, the Supreme Court of Georgia asked to hear this case in the first place. But it also means there's a lot of uncertainty out there about what the law requires and what the practical ramifications of any ruling might be.
So the only procedural issue is in a situation like this, where a public invokes, the public invokes the right, undisclosed, they didn't walk up to court's window, but they sent an email to a court officer, to the court reporter, and said, I'd like a copy of the audio recording. And when that court reporter says, I've been instructed by the judge not to give you a copy, well, at that point, you have to go into court and make a motion, which I don't mean to be too simple, but as we all know, a motion is the vehicle by which you ask a court to do something. So,
Mr. Cobb, the real problem here is that you can't just go to the clerk's office and ask for a copy of the audio tapes from the court reporter in a hearing. We've moved well beyond what is traditionally a court record. We've moved into something that's really the grist through which our judicial system is made. And so if you can get access to an audio tape that a court reporter prepares a transcript from, why under the same principle can't you get access to drafts of a judge's decision?
Well, the rule that exists in this state, the rule that we think should be reaffirmed in this case, would not give anybody access to drafts of a judicial decision. Because the rule says a court record is either something that's filed, meaning you can go to the clerk's office, or it is an official court record that memorializes what happens in open court.
Another big issue in this litigation, and if I was going to guess, will probably be the ultimate issue in this litigation, is the procedural question of how the trial tape should be requested, if they can be requested at all. So assuming access to tapes is permitted, the case law hasn't yet addressed what someone in our position should actually have done to get the court records, especially in a case like this that's no longer actively being heard before the courts. But while theoretically there are other ways undisclosed could have stopped the records, our position in this case has been that not only is a motion the method contemplated by Rule 21, that's also the method that's best designed to protect the rights of all parties with interest in it.
This is an important issue of access to public records and transparency in open government.
Well, this is an old case, correct? It's been closed for how long?
The case is not administratively closed, yes. It's not closed as to undisclosed, and it's certainly not closed as to Mr. Watkins, who still maintains his innocence. But administratively closed in terms of having a final conviction and habeas proceedings in state and federal court, yes.
Do you have any precedent for a Rule 21 motion being filed in a case that has been administratively closed?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
The state pointed out, I don't think this is disputed, that the three or four cases you cited regarding Rule 21 motions were all in cases that were pending at the time. And there, one of the issues today is the right vehicle for bringing a Rule 21 motion to the court. And there's some authority in our cases that you should have brought a separate lawsuit against the judge. Doesn't that make more sense in a case like this one,
absolutely,
where
not.
It's been administratively closed?
Absolutely not. The idea of putting parties in a position where they have to affirmatively open a new case file and then name as a defendant the one party who is least likely to have any privacy interest at all doesn't make sense. The goal here should be to get at who might object to the public distribution of these records and then to give them the opportunity to object. If you set up a regime in which you have to sue a judge, you're going to leave out the parties that might have an interest. Here it's Joey Watkins.
Why don't you just add this? Why don't you say you also have to sue these other people?
They're not subject to mandamus. Mandamus is only subject. Only government officials are subject to mandamus. And there's also a question. There's another case pending before this court, Your Honor, called the Merchant Law Firm versus Emerson that was argued orally about 6 weeks ago. And in that case, I don't agree with this argument, but the government, represented by the Attorney General, has made a contention that mandamus is never appropriate in a situation like this because there is a discretionary aspect to the second step of the common law analysis. And if they're right, I don't think they are, but if they're right, then mandamus is not the option. There might be other options, which, candidly, you could require intervention, effectively reopening the case file and having a member of the public come in to intervene. But that doesn't accord with ideals of judicial efficiency. There you're putting in place two hurdles before a member of the public gets access to a public record. You're requiring them to file a motion for intervention, presumably for the limited purpose of obtaining a copy of this record, litigating that motion, winning that motion, and then having to file a second motion for access to the records. Here, we've got a recognition in the common law and in Rule 21 that the general public has a right of access. So why put another hurdle in their place before they can get access to those? There needs to be a vehicle, an efficient vehicle, for enforcing the common law right. That's what Rule 21 does. And it talks about
motions. Is there any limit to this principle? Could you come in and file a motion in a case that was closed in 1850, but there's still a case number kicking around?
I don't see why not. I don't think that's likely to happen. The argument we are making here, we were talking earlier about what Rule 21 is and what the common law is. The contention of undisclosed is that Rule 21 is a procedural vehicle for the common law right. So we think we invoked Rule 21 and the common law by filing this motion. And if our right to copy, which is part of the right to access, is going to be restricted in any way, then under the rules which govern the procedural enforcement of this right, the court has to do what the rules say it has to do. And it didn't do that here, and two decisions by this court have held that that's reversible error.
What if we're not inclined to take the long road down the common law and ignore the substance of Rule 21, and we do want to evaluate the definition of inspect? Are you acknowledging that that does not include textually or implicitly right to copy, or what is your best argument that the term inspect includes copy?
It goes back to rule. Our best argument, Your Honor, goes back to Rule 1. I don't think that's how the court should rule, but if it's going to rely on the word inspect, the concern that might be driving your question is the idea that you can issue an opinion that interprets the word inspect to mean inspect and copy, and that that term inspect and that resulting opinion might conflict with, for example, the Open Records Act, which uses the language inspect and copy. And you run into statutory construction principles like expressio unis or the notion that we don't interpret statutes to render them mere surplusage. I think that's the concern that you're probably getting at. And you can avoid that concern if you're going to rely on Rule 21 and interpret the term inspect by dropping a footnote, I think, in the opinion that says something to the effect of, under Rule 1, the Uniform Superior Court rules are not substantive law. So our decision here is limited to interpretation of the Uniform Superior Court.
What does substantive law mean?
Substantive law means, obviously, affirmative enactments by the legislature pursuant to the legislative power. And I'd argue it includes the common law for two reasons.
Well, but the common law of what?
Common law of the state.
Well, no, sure. Common law like procedure? Or a common law, like a tort claim.
Like a tort claim, but the common law right of access is a substantive right, meaning I can go into court and invoke that and get relief. There is substance to that. It's not just a procedural issue.
So when the court, all right, so Rule 1 says is not the intention to conflict with the substantive law, and so when the council or whatever the entity that is that enacts these rules.
It's the Supreme Court with the aid of the
Council
of Superior Court judges.
And when the Council of Superior Court judges said all court records are available for public inspection and did not use the word copy, that conflicts with the substantive law. That's your position.
That is our position. But I was answering a question from Justice Kaplan that assumed my position.
Well, no, but I'm using that same assumption, which is that the word inspection does not include copying.
That is not our position.
Your position is that the word inspection includes copying?
Our position is that if this court is going to rule in reliance on the text of Rule 21, then yes, it should render a decision that interprets inspect to mean inspect and copy.
Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio products. Users can sign up as Audible listeners, which gives them book credits and access to short programs now playing in channels every month for a low monthly fee. Customers simply download their choices and can access them on their iPhone, Android device, Fire tablet, iPod, or other MP3 player. Membership with Audible includes one free audiobook a month, exclusive sales of 30% off all regularly priced audiobooks, and unlimited access to channels content. Plus, they have the Great Listen Guarantee. You didn't like your download? You can just swap it out for something else. Now, luckily, that wasn't the case for me with my recent download. That was a version control by Dexter Palmer. The sci-fi novel is set in the near future and focuses upon a customer services agent for an online matchmaking company and her physicist husband who's working on a time machine, or as his team calls it, a causality violation device. The book is not only entertaining as sci-fi, but it also tackles subjects ranging from race relations to the power of social media. And it has maybe the best audiobook narrator ever in January Lavoie. And now, Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. So go to audible.com/undisclosed. That's audible.com/undisclosed and get started today.
The state of Georgia argued in its brief that, quote, under undisclosed theory, the floodgates would be open wide for public dissemination of all kinds of non-official court records, if our motion is granted. But an important practical point to consider here is that just because the court finds there's a right to copy the court audio doesn't mean that such a right would exist for all court records all the time.
Think about a confidential informant in a current prosecution being prosecuted in their community, where their voice could be recognized, thus compromising the government's investigation. Think about trade secret disputes. There are reasons that this presumption of accessibility can be overcome, but none of those reasons exist here. I mean, to me, a win in this case is a pretty narrow holding that does two things, that does not depart from what the law in Georgia has said for 25 years, that these audio recordings are court records, and two, that says the presumption of accessibility has not been overcome, so undisclosed, you get them. I don't think we're going to get some sweeping affirmation of, of these flowery principles of access to the courts.
So if the law, if next week they stopped using audio recordings in the courtroom and they just started using a stenography machine, would you have a right to copy those stenographer notes?
I think the natural extension of our argument is that you would. And it would be unusable for us. It wouldn't give undisclosed what you want, because you wouldn't get any of the atmospheric points, the voice tone, inflection, pauses, sarcasm. But they're court records because they're the official recording of what happens. I can't think of a legitimate distinction that would say, no, if you choose stenographers, a stenographic method, then we don't get it. I think we get it.
So, and if a judge is just trying to keep awake at the bench by taking contemporaneous notes,
It's not an official court reporter's record of what happened. Now, if the judge read his notes, then it would be. But there is a limited judicial privilege that protects, for example, communications between staff attorneys and judges. And I'd argue that it extends to judges' thinking. As a lawyer, if somebody were to ask for my notes, even if I, am interviewing Naveen and I write down verbatim what he says or attempt to, I'd still say that's work product.
Right.
Because it's the words are going into my ears, into my brain, and necessarily being processed by a lawyer's brain. So,
but isn't that what the court reporter's doing too?
It's not a lawyer. And she's charged with creating the official record of what happened, whereas I, as a lawyer, am not. And I've got work product protection that she doesn't.
And it's also worth noting here that although there isn't much case law addressing this issue in Georgia, there is some. In fact, there actually is a previous Georgia Supreme Court case that says a record of a court proceeding, like a trial tape, is a court record. That was Green v. Drennan in 1992, in which a newspaper was seeking an audio recording of a judge's comments from the bench. Quote, Judge Green waived any right to claim that the tape of his comments is not a court record when he made public comments from the bench that were recorded while court was in session. No law limits public access to the judge's tape comments, nor can access to them be denied under the procedure set out in Rule 21, which he has not invoked. Therefore, the tape or its transcript must be made available for public inspection under Rule 21. Which sounds pretty good for us, and it is, except with a giant caveat in the form of the Supreme Court's request for a supplemental briefing, which it issued only 2 weeks before oral arguments. In that request, the court asked, notwithstanding the court's decision in Green v. Drennan, does the common law right of access to court records, when applied in the context of records of a particular case, extend to records beyond the official record of the court? Now, that notwithstanding in the court's request may be a clue as to how the court wants to decide here. At the very least, it's a big warning that when it comes to this appeal, we shouldn't be putting all our eggs in Green v. Drennan's basket.
Right. Don't you think the way that they're if we lose, the way that we're likely to lose is by defining a audio recording as not a part of the official record?
Exactly right.
And that's where your biggest fight's going to be. Because I don't think they're going to want to write a decision that suggests you can't copy, or the spec doesn't mean copy.
I don't think they want to touch that.
I think they want to write it solely on the question of whether.
But didn't Green decide that was a court record?
Well, that's what they told us in the order.
Presented
the question, basically.
Well, that's
It says ignore Green.
It says notwithstanding Green.
Right. Because right. somebody
they want to revisit Green.
Somebody in the court said, "I want to revisit Green." Someone else is like, "Well, so can I neutralize this? What did that?"
Let's talk about that, because Green is a categorical decision. There is no qualification and no caveat in the statement that an official court reporter's audio recording is a court record. So what they may be thinking of kind of like limited overruling, where they're just adding components to that test, right? That it's not the case.
Where there is a transcript, it is not the
right.
official record.
Or, I mean, Green is a good case for us because it's open court. To me, the distinction between open court and outside of court is a really important one, and the fact that it's the official court record. Those are the two facts that I think should drive where this decision goes, because it limits the scope of the rule. It takes away the risk that Tom raised about getting into a judge's files, and it focuses on the policy that drives this right, which is access to courts and shining light on government. If something happens in open court, and I could have walked in and seen it and heard it, and presumably gone to tell people all about it, then why should someone who didn't have the privilege of going to see it and hear it be limited in their ability?
Here's a question. In a felony conviction appeal, goes up to, say, the Georgia Supreme Court on appeal, does the lower court send the audio? Probably not.
Only if it's in the record. Sometimes it is if there's no transcript.
Yeah. So the question then is, how could this possibly be the official court record if we don't even ask for it in death penalty
cases? But
the public
record access is not designed to give us access to what's in the appellate.
Well, but the point is that if it were truly an official court record, you would expect it to be part of the record that is automatically transmitted to the
high court so often.
Right.
But they've asked us to focus
on
what
they're going to think.
They've asked us to focus on
they're like, we don't have opinions that have audio segments to it. We don't have oral arguments where people are, well, they actually do sometimes.
They sometimes do. And, look,
audio
we've got decisions saying that exhibits that are not entered into evidence are part of the court record, subject to right of access, and those don't go up because they're not part of the transcript, if they're not part of the evidence.
You know, that's a point about the workability of alternative rules. In this case, it wasn't relevant to the appeal. But there are cases where audiovisual materials are relevant to the decision of even the appellate courts.
But then they're going to be, the way the question is phrased, it wants us to focus on what's not in the official record of the court. In your example, they will be. So they're presuming that those are court records. We're talking about what's not in the official record.
It's time to make your next move, whatever it is. You could be changing careers, starting a business, or maybe launching a creative project like a podcast. Whatever your next move is, you know you're going to need a beautifully designed website to pull it off. And there is no better partner to help you with that than Squarespace. With Squarespace, you can lock down your next move idea with a unique domain. Squarespace will help you create a website to launch your idea, publish your portfolio to get your project out there, open an online store for business, and more. Squarespace is used by a wide range of people, to include businesses and creatives like musicians, designers, artists, restaurants. Maybe most importantly, it's used by us, podcasters. So maybe podcasting is your next move, huh? Whatever you're going to do, build that great website with Squarespace. Here's how. Go to www.squarespace.com and at checkout, use our promo code undisclosed. You're going to get 10% off that first website. That's www.squarespace.com, promo code undisclosed. You know it's time. Make your next move with Squarespace.
After the moot, the Kapp and Cobb team had a nice relaxing weekend full of legal research and oral argument prep, and then on Monday we met again in the Supreme Court. Now, thanks to the fact that the Supreme Court of Georgia is itself committed to judicial transparency and access, oral arguments before them are made available to everyone online. So rather than hearing me now try and recap the arguments, you can actually listen for yourself.
S17A1061, Undisclosed LLC versus the State et al., James Cobb for appellant, John McClellan for appellee.
Mr. Cobb, we're ready when you are, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is James Cobb. I'm counsel for Undisclosed. I'm going to attempt to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time. We'll see how that works out. Undisclosed is a podcast, and for those on the bench who might not be familiar with what exactly a podcast is, you can think of it as a serialized radio show. This show in particular focuses on criminal justice issues, is distributed exclusively through the internet, is available for download or streaming on demand. Undisclosed has been very successful. It gets somewhere between 1 and 2 million listens for every episode. And the case before us today arises out of season 2 of Undisclosed, where they did a deep investigation into the prosecution and conviction of Joey Watkins in Floyd County Superior Court for murder in 2001. As part of its investigation, Undisclosed made a request for a copy of 3 audio recordings, 2 of them from pretrial hearings, and then the tapes of the trial itself. That request was denied, and Undisclosed responded with a motion for access under Rule 21. That motion was then denied, and now we are here today. The court has asked the parties to focus. This is a discretionary appeal, and the court has asked the parties to focus on 3 issues in particular. I intend to do that. But before I get into those issues, I'd like the court to keep in mind 3 very important points for this appeal, for the duration of my argument, and for the duration of the argument by my brother from the government. Point 1, up until last Thursday, just last Thursday, nobody in this case, not my client Undisclosed, not the defendant Joey Watkins, not the state of Georgia, and not even the trial court, nobody disputed that these audio recordings are what we call court records, which is a term of art in Georgia to signify materials that are subject to the right of access. And then for the very first time last Thursday, the state filed a supplemental brief in which it argued that these audio recordings are not court records. But the court needs to keep in mind that the only appeal filed from the trial court's order is our appeal, in which we did not enumerate as error the trial court's conclusion that these audio recordings are court records. So that issue of whether these are court records or not is not properly before this court. That's point 1. Point 2, if these audio recordings are court records, which they are, then they are presumptively accessible to the public. And that presumption of accessibility can be overcome only if there is a finding by the trial court, supported by evidence, that some compelling private interest outweighs the public's interest in access to these documents, these recordings. There was no finding here. The state did not respond to Undisclosed motion. So there's no evidence of any compelling private interest that would outweigh the public's interest in access to these recordings. So that's point 2 I'd ask the court to keep in mind. And point 3 is a more practical one. What are these audio recordings? They are not the property of the court reporter. These are official materials of the court. They are the original records created by an official court reporter that were subsequently transcribed into a transcript, but they are owned by the court. And that's set by statute and by guidance from the Judicial Council of Georgia. So those are the 3 points I'd like this court to keep in mind. Let's get to the issues.
Well, let's come back to the first point, counsel. Obviously, the state would not have appealed the determination by the trial court that these tapes are court records because the state won below. So the fact that you've appealed and that the state did not cross appeal an order that they won, I mean, the conclusion of whether a record is a court record is a conclusion of law, right?
I would agree with that. Okay. Well, I would put a finer point on it.
There may be facts that are relevant, but it is ultimately a conclusion of law that we would review de novo. And we're not bound to a legal error, to follow a legal error that we find simply because it wasn't enumerated as error, are we?
Jurisprudentially, I don't think this court should upset a trial court's order, at least a component of it that hasn't been appealed or subject to a cross appeal.
Right, for any reason?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever heard of right for any reason?
I have, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if the trial court's order was correct for any reason, well, so let's talk about what exactly the trial court's order did. It concluded that these were audio recordings. It concluded that Undisclosed has a right to listen to them, but it restricted that right of access by preventing Undisclosed from copying those orders. So if the recordings, so if this court is going to affirm the trial court's order, what it's going to be affirming is the prohibition on copying. Now that was one of the three issues that the court asked the parties to focus on in its briefing, which the parties did. That is whether Rule 21 and the underlying common law right of access to court records includes as a component a right to copy.
That's the big issue, but before you get to that, can you just touch on the first question we posed about whether this is the right way to initiate this kind of action?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. This is the right way to initiate this kind of action. Rule 21 recognizes the public's general right, common law right, of access to court records, and it sets out a procedure by which the right of access can be restricted in some way. There are two points the court that are particularly important to this issue. The first is that the trial court here expressly directed Undisclosed to pursue its right through a Rule 21 motion. So Undisclosed did exactly what the trial court told it to do, and it shouldn't be penalized now if it turns out that direction
is inappropriate. We have cases that say if the trial court tells a pro se habeas petitioner to file a direct appeal and he doesn't file an application for CPC, it's dismissed as a matter of jurisdiction. So that doesn't get you very far.
There's another point the court should consider. There are three cases from this court in which it has at least implicitly authorized the use of a Rule 21 motion by a non-party like Undisclosed. And in this case, Undisclosed followed the procedure that was followed by the parties in those cases, and nobody questioned the parties and the non-parties in those cases.
Did any of those cases involve either a criminal case or a closed case?
Those cases, they did not involve closed cases, and Your Honor's correct about that. There is a third point, Justice Namias, that I think you should keep in mind when considering this point. Let's think about what the trial court here did. The trial court first told Undisclosed, you can copy these records. And then as Undisclosed went up to Floyd County to engage in the copying, the trial court switched course and said, no, you can't. You can listen to them, but you can't copy them. That was not a written order, but it was a direction, I'd call it an order, an oral order, from the trial court restricting Undisclosed access to these records. Undisclosed then files a motion under Rule 21. And if the court focuses on the language of Rule 21.5, 21.5 provides a procedure by which, and the rule uses the language any person. It doesn't talk about a party. It doesn't talk about the court. It says any person may file a motion under 21.5 to request a modification or amendment of an order that restricts access to a public court record. And you could construe what Undisclosed did here as filing a motion, as any person filing a motion under Rule 21.5.
What is your best case for that assertion?
For the assertion that...
What is your best authority for your assertion that you're asserting right there, how they could get here?
I think it's Rule 21.5, Your Honor. I don't have a case that blesses this theory. We do have three decisions by this court that talk generally about accessibility.
All right, so you're saying the rule itself, right?
Rule itself.
And of your case authority, which case would be best, you think?
So other cases, there's a Savannah College of Art and Design case. There's the NRA Atlanta Journal-Constitution case. And there is the Atlanta Journal versus Long.
Those cases and the rule get you around the ability to intervene. And I think it's generally accepted in jurisdiction that you can intervene in an ongoing case as a non-party when the right of access, not just access to court records, but same with public courtroom. If you're denied access to a closed courtroom, you're allowed to intervene and get heard. My question is more, when the case is closed, could even a party to the case, is it the right process to come in a closed case and file a Rule 21 motion if you were a party to unseal, or is it properly brought as a mandamus or as a separate suit? Because you say we have three cases. We also have some cases where it was a direct suit. So which one of our cases was right?
The cases in which Rule 21 was the basis. Those are the cases that are correct here. And to your specific question, Justice Namias, the fact that this case was closed in some way doesn't affect the court's ongoing jurisdiction to address issues that may touch on it. And that doesn't often come up in Rule 21. The case law that we have and the case law from other states primarily arises in the context of ongoing prosecutions. But there are other instances in which parties often come back to a court after a case has been closed. Attorney's liens, for example, or motions for attorney's fees that follow entry of final judgment. And in a traditional sense, in those cases...
Well, the attorney fees, it's only because there's a specific statute and it sets a time limit. Otherwise, you're late, so that doesn't help you.
There might not be a statute here, but there is a common law right of access that doesn't end with the conclusion of a case. And while finality is without a doubt an important judicial value, nothing about what Undisclosed did here disrupts the finality of Mr. Watkins's prosecution.
Do you have a case in which the common law right of access was applied via a filing in a closed case?
Via a filing of a motion for access in a closed case?
Right.
I don't believe we have a case for that point.
So the existence of the common law right of access, which there's no dispute about that, doesn't answer the question of the right remedy to vindicate that right.
No, it doesn't. And there are other reasons. So Justice Nami has pointed to a couple of other options that might exist. You could require intervention, for example. You could require this to be pursued through mandamus. And I can't point you to a case that says either one of those is improper. There are two cases in which mandamus was used. The Gwinnett County Grand Jury case that wasn't mandamus, but it was a petition for relief. And the Green versus Drennan case, which is our best authority on a different point. But in those cases, there was no existing case file.
Right.
Within which a Rule 21 motion could be filed.
Well, and that's I think, an important point. And if we can, let's pivot to the court records question.
Sure.
In Green, the issue in Green did not relate to any particular case. And it's hard to imagine how Green could have come out any differently because, ordinarily the transcript is the record of what happened during court. What happened in Green happened prior to the calling of any cases, and so it would not be part of any transcript that was subsequently created. So the requester had to go to the court reporter to get a transcript specially prepared, and it was at that point that the judge said, you can't do this. In this case, you have a transcript that has been prepared of this case. That is the official record of what transpired in the case. If your argument as to what counts as a court record applies, based on my best understanding of what you've argued in your supplemental brief, how far does that extend? I mean, anything that is quoted in open court, let's say that my staff attorney prepares a bench brief for this argument, and I quote from that bench brief in asking you a question. Has that bench brief been converted into a record subject to the right of access?
If I know that you are quoting from a bench brief, and if you are relying upon that, and it doesn't invade the judicial privilege, that's another important point that the court should keep in mind. There is a generally applicable privilege that applies between staff attorneys or law clerks and a member of the bench. And that, to me, is similar to the attorney work product. If your bench memo is imbued with your thoughts, your law clerk's thoughts, which it often will be, and when your law clerk is writing his or her recitation of the facts in that bench memo, it's coming through the filter through which your law clerk views this case. So I think the direct answer to that question, Your Honor, is that no, because there's a privilege that would prevent us from getting access to that. But in the Smith decision,
but simply quoting from it without the application of that privilege, it would be subject to the court records?
There might be a waiver issue there, but the argument that we have made in this case, we've proposed a rule that the court could adopt and rule in our favor. And it's not a new rule. It's a reaffirmation of the rule that's existed in this state since 1992, is that if a court record, a court material, something that's created by an official of the court, is a memorialization of what occurred in an open court proceeding, then it's a court record. Now, that doesn't answer the question, Your Honor, of whether I get a right to copy it as a member of the public. It just answers the first question in the two-step analysis. So there's a two-step analysis to determine whether a document is available for copying. The first step is it a court record? The second step is there a compelling private interest that overcomes the presumptiveness of the accessibility right?
Would you assert then that, most trial judges make notes during trial? Are you saying that their notes then are public record?
Absolutely not. They would be subject to the judicial privilege.
All right, now, how about the juror's notes? You usually give them now particularly in a lengthy trial. Here, these are the pads. Make notes if you'd like to. Happens all the time. Are those covered?
I think that question is going to turn on some nuances that I might not be prepared to answer. I can't say categorically no, because there might be instances in which you're alleging juror misconduct. And if a juror saves the notes and I sue or seek discovery from that juror, there are times I can get into the juror's.
But you don't get them as court records. You get them as a third party. You get them potentially as evidence for some legal issue.
Just as if there might be a, you know, you might challenge the transcript is inaccurate, you can, you know, then file an action to review the recording to determine whether the transcript is inaccurate, right?
Yes, and I don't think anybody here disputes that that's the proper course when challenging the accuracy of a transcript. On your point, Justice Namias, the ownership of the records is critically important. What we are dealing with here, these audio recordings, are the original record, the primary source material of what happened in the trial of Mr. Watkins, a trial that resulted in his life sentence for murder. And if these types of records are not court records, as that term is used, even though they're outside the file, they don't sit in the case file for Mr. Watkins's prosecution, I don't know what else
you
could
be. You know, I hear these glorified, this is the most important thing in the history, but this is a traditional common law right. There have been backup stenographic records for court reporters going back to the beginning of court reporting, and yet, as at best I can tell, you cite two kind of tangential cases that go your way. Every other case that addresses this specific issue of backup to court reporting transcripts seems to go the other way. So if this is the most important thing in public access ever, it's somewhat surprising that this is the first time it's ever been raised in a court and you think it should come out your way.
I don't dispute that when you look at the outcomes of the cases we've cited, it's pretty balanced. The courts that go our way from an outcome perspective and the courts that go the other way from an outcome perspective. But there are distinctions we pointed out in our briefs.
Give me a couple that come out your way.
We cited three in our supplemental brief. The Smith versus United States District Court decision. We cited the, and I'm coming
that
up on
really
my
three
minutes
left. Doesn't
really
come out your way.
Well, it does. And Smith is a case in which, similar to Justice Peterson's example, there was an internal court memo, not from a staff attorney to a judge, but from the clerk of court to a judge, that talked about the frequency with which.
I mean, again, that's general principles you argue from, but specific issue of court reporter backup. What are your best cases? You cite a tangential North Carolina and Louisiana case. You got anything else?
We actually didn't cite those cases. The first
okay, well, they're cited. Are there any cases?
We cited a decision from New Jersey, the Atlantic City Convention Center decision, right. And we cited a decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Commonwealth versus Upshur. Both of those involve backup recordings. Now, the Atlantic City Convention Center case is not about a court proceeding, but it's about a public record. And I've run into my rebuttal time. Unless there are further questions from the court, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
You have about 2 minutes left, Mr. Cobb.
May it please the court, I'm John McClellan, Assistant District Attorney in the Rome Judicial Circuit on behalf of the state of Georgia in this case. The court asked the counsel in this case initially to address two issues, and then about 2 weeks ago added a third issue to this, and I'm going to address those issues. The first, whether this is a proper vehicle in which to bring this action. The Watkins case was tried back in 2001, in July of 2001. Joey Watkins was convicted back in 2001. That case was appealed to this court. This court unanimously affirmed that conviction. In fact, three of the justices presently sitting on the court joined in that affirmance, and one of the justices currently sitting on the court wrote that opinion affirming that conviction. That case was over with, done with. It was remitted to the trial court. That case was closed. At that point, the trial court had no jurisdiction over the Joey Watkins case unless it was to address and correct a Boyd sentence. Mr. Watkins was not serving a probated sentence, so there wouldn't be any jurisdiction through the period of probation. There was no, at that time, there was no jurisdiction to re-sentence him, and at that time, there was only really one sentence that could be handed out for murder, which was life in prison.
So how should undisclosed have gone about getting these records?
A writ of mandamus. the Merchant case that is currently pending before this court. That was a case where the order of writ of mandamus was sought against the judge in Douglas County and the court reporter, making them parties in that case.
But if Rule 21 was promulgated to codify the common law, why isn't that the right avenue to vindicate that common law right?
Because there is no case in which to intervene at that point. This case, and if there was a case to intervene, if it had been done at that time, there would have been a case where undisclosed or any other party who was excluded, who believed that they were excluded from public access to the trial, could have gone in and sought intervention in Rule 21. But that's not what happened in this case.
I've got a question that assumes the answer to a different question that you've been asked. So bear with me. But let's assume that the court concluded that these were not, in fact, court records. At that point, is there any discretion for the judge to choose to release these records? Or if they're not court records, are they automatically barred from retrieval by any party?
If they're not court records, the state takes a position there was nothing for the trial court to address at that point. And here, you had a transcript, as the justices, as you have talked about earlier, which is the official record of this trial. There was a record before the court that incorporated such things as the indictment, the waiver of arraignment and the plea of not guilty, the jury's verdict, the jury's sentencing, the motion for new trial, the denial of that motion for new trial, and those were official court records as part of this. And in fact, the N. Ray Gwinnett County case, they made a distinction based on several instances. Number one, they talked about the traditional right to have free discussion in the grand jury. They talked about public and private, what was traditionally publicly disclosed and what is not. But they also talked about court records and, quote, court records in that decision.
Let's come back to Justice Grant's question, but let's tweak it slightly. Let's assume that these are not court records and that the court reporter has retained physical custody of the recording. What authority does the trial judge have to tell the court reporter not to release a copy of that recording if they're not a court record?
I don't think the trial court would have that jurisdiction.
So then is that decision in the hands of the court reporter?
If it's not a court record, if it's in the hands of the court reporter, that would be an action against the court reporter at that point. I hadn't thought about that. Right. Second is the trial court's order itself in this case. The trial court did grant access to undisclosed to these transcripts. They did not give the right to copy these transcripts, but gave the right to access these transcripts. In other parts of the Georgia Code, specifically in the discovery statute dealing with criminal cases, specifically dealing with the Open Records Act, specifically dealing with the records of campus police departments, there is a right to inspect those records. And to copy those records. And both words are used in those code sections, inspect and copy. In Rule 21, the word copy does not appear. Only inspect access applies there.
Although counsel for undisclosed has cited a wealth of case law making very clear that the common law right included the right to copy. Are you suggesting that Rule 21 somehow narrowed the common law right?
I think it has. You've got to go back to the rules of statutory construction, and the rules of inspect means one thing, copy means other thing.
But doesn't the first provision of the Uniform Superior Court rules say that nothing in the rules were intended to change substantive law, and it was the substantive law of this state that the common law was in effect? I mean, are you suggesting that the Uniform Superior Court rule changed the common law?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that it changed the common law.
Are you arguing that the common law didn't include a right to copy?
It does not include the right to copy in this particular case. It includes the right to inspect. That's all Rule 21 does.
But that's not this case. That's all cases,
saying. That's in all cases.
But I was asking you about the common law. Pre-Rule 21, Pre-Rule 21, did the common law afford a right to copy court records?
I'm not certain that it did. And when the common law is codified in such things as the Open Records Act...
The common law was not codified in the Open Records Act because there is no common law to public documents, only to court documents.
Yes, sir.
So the Open Records Act is what the Open Records Act says, according to the General Assembly.
Yes, sir. That's a good question, Justice.
So if the common law prior to the promulgation of Rule 21 included the right to copy, and if we've said that the Superior Court rules are not intended to change the substantive law of this state, then wouldn't that necessarily require us to conclude that Rule 21 includes the right to copy?
Under that scenario, it would include the rule to copy if this was a court record, okay. if this was an official court record. I will concede that point. And the third argument is whether this is a court record to begin with. And that's the issue the court asked us to address, I think, about 2.5 weeks ago in this case. And the official court record includes the transcript. It includes, as I said, the indictment. It includes the jury verdict. It includes the sentencing. It includes the motion for new trial. It does not include those backup court reportings that the court reporter is not even required to make. Court recorder has to keep either a stenographic record or make a stenographic record or a recording, but there's no even requirement of a recording under Georgia statute.
Well, there's a requirement of one of the two, right?
Well, one of the two.
So if they didn't make a stenographic record, then they were required to make a recording.
They were required to copy. But that is not the official court record in this case.
Why not?
Because Georgia courts have held that in the past. It is not the official court record. Those are the cases cited in our brief.
Those are two. I mean, official court record is, in context, one thing. That's not necessarily the limit of public access because, for example, you have Green. You certainly have other cases where you get things that were not an official court record of any case.
Right. And I was setting aside Green versus, or notwithstanding Green versus Drennan, as addressing in that particular context. But there are other court records. For example, there is a certificate of discovery filed in every criminal case where the state and the defendant says we have served certain records on the other party in this case. In our case, it would be incident reports, investigative summaries, plea recommendations.
All that stuff, though, is that it never occurs in court, right? That's easily distinguishable. Those things are references to things that didn't happen in court. They're no different than a witness testifying to something that happened on the street. That doesn't make the recording of what happened on the street by the bank surveillance camera a court record.
The plea recommendation does get mentioned in court at sentencing in the case. Frequently, the state will mention what we have recommended in this particular case.
Okay, and are you saying the plea recommendation that if it's made in open court, that is not potentially a court record?
I'm saying if that's mentioned, not the actual written plea recommendation that's been served on the defense in discovery is not a court record.
All right, well, let's do the plea recommendation, which may have been made in open court. If that was actually recorded by the court reporter.
That is a part of the transcript, and that would be part of the court record.
Well, the plea recommendation is going to be made in open court. It's going to be transcribed as part of a plea.
Yes, sir. But I'm talking about those documents served beforehand.
Okay. I want to make sure I've got Mr. According to my understanding, Mr. Cobb says his best authority is Rule 21. And I think what you're arguing is your best authority is Rule 21.
Yes, sir.
So the question is, what does Rule 21 say, right?
Yes, sir. Okay.
You had agreed
cutting to the chase on it.
You had agreed that a court recording could be a court record in the absence of a transcript. Is there something about the creation of a transcript that strips an earlier court record of its status as a court record?
It is not the official court record. Once that transcript is prepared, the transcript is the official court record. It is the only official court record of those proceedings at that point.
But what is it about the creation of that official court record that strips the earlier recording of its value or status as a record to be released to the public?
Because the courts in Georgia have held over the years, in many cases, that is the official, that the transcript is the official court record. The statute statutory law says that is the official court record.
Right, but does anything say that the recording is therefore stripped of any access to the public?
It's never been given, it's never been accorded the status of an official court record at the time.
Except when there isn't a transcript.
Yes.
So it has been in that context. So it's circular to say it is a court record, and then once it's turned into a transcript, it's not a court record because we have cases that don't deal with this issue.
Right. Green v. Drennan specifically said you have to release either the transcript or the recording in that case.
Well, but it also said a tape is a court record, right?
Yes.
What do we do about that?
The state takes a position that once that transcript is prepared, that becomes the official court record, and that recording is not. And in this case, Undisclosed was granted access to those recordings in any event.
What would be the downside of ruling in favor of the appellant in this case?
Your Honor, I didn't hear the question.
What would be the downside in ruling in favor of the appellant in this case?
You know, there has to be some closure brought to criminal cases. And closure is brought to a criminal case traditionally.
Well, this claim doesn't undermine the finality of the criminal case.
No, but if there's not some finality brought to a criminal case, it could open the door for other avenues.
I mean, that goes back to your argument, maybe Rule 21 is not the right way, but even if it was completely closed, you concede you can get a writ of mandamus.
Yes, sir.
At any point.
At any point.
Okay, so what's the harm?
I don't know what the final effect would be.
Mr. McClellan, you are saying, and I think, that if Mr. Cobb had proceeded by mandamus, he could get that what he wants. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
You're saying he could get this tape by mandamus?
No, he could seek writ of mandamus, and then okay. It would go back to the court and go back to the same issues addressed in the Merchant case.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. It would go back to those same issues.
Yes, sir. And the argument made on behalf of the state in the Merchant case has concluded come to the same conclusion the state has come to in this case.
But there's nothing that causes a recording of a trial to intrude on the finality of a murder case any more than the transcript would, isn't that right?
The Justice Grant, you're correct on that.
So then I'll go back to Justice Benham's question, which is, what's the downside of finding that these documents, that these recordings can be or should be or must be released?
I don't know if there's a practical downside, Your Honor, but the law says that the transcript is the official record. In this case, there are recordings, and Undisclosed has been granted access. But I don't know there's a practical downside.
It would still be the official record. I mean, if a reporter comes to court and takes notes and then goes out there's a camera in here right now. That's not the official record.
Yes, Your Honor.
If they then broadcast that doesn't make their broadcast the official record.
No, Your Honor.
So what's the harm?
I don't know there's a practical harm, Your Honor.
Anything further?
I don't have anything further.
Mr. McClellan, thank you. Mr. Cobb, I think you have
a couple of minutes, Your Honor. Excuse me, and I'm going to make just a couple of points on rebuttal. What's the downside? There is absolutely no downside.
Well, let me ask, there's a rule about broadcasting from court that is pretty elaborate, and it's actually under review now. If we say this is okay, then rather than following Rule 22, Superior Court Rule 22, why not in every case, if you want the records, you just go in as soon as the evidence is presented, if it's real time especially, ask for the tape that afternoon and then take the tape and go broadcast it?
Because if you rule in Undisclosed favor here and conclude that the audio recordings are court records, it's not going to necessarily mean that in every case I get to copy the audio recordings.
Why not?
There's a two-step analysis that has to be conducted.
Well, but in a case where there's no findings issue, it's just the broadcast of what happened in open court. Why can't you go in the next that afternoon of every single day of trial and say, I didn't go through Rule 22, but give me the tapes from today and don't deny me because...
If you are requesting access to the audio recordings, there are going to be instances where a party in interest has legitimate objections to the publication of those recordings. Think of a child molestation prosecution where perhaps the child testifies, or a confidential informant in a local prosecution where somebody could recognize the witness's voice. There might be reasons that the audio recording should not be released. We have none of those reasons here. So if the court were to rule in undisclosed favor...
But so those are reasons that would all come in the second prong of the Rule 21 analysis.
Exactly.
They're not reasons that... I mean, apart from losing the second prong of Rule 21, is there any reason why this wouldn't just subsume Rule 22? I mean, there are reasons we have a separate rule for broadcasting.
There certainly is. And there are reasons. And this is the second part of my answer to Justice Namias's question. The purpose of Rule 22 is to prevent disruption in the courtroom. It primarily sets out a process by which broadcasters have to follow if they want to come in and set up cameras and make their presence in the courtroom a tangible thing. Well, that could be disruptive to the proceedings in court.
Well, the chief has given me an opportunity to ask one more question. For a long time, the state of Kentucky had a rule where at the end of the day in the trial of a case, you pay $75 and you get a video of that particular case. Is that the direction in which you'd like for us to go?
That's a great rule, Your Honor. And if I may answer the question a little more fully, it is a rule that's entirely consistent with what this court in particular does. Of all the courts in the country, this court is at the forefront of government transparency. As Justice Namias acknowledged, I'm on camera right now. And every word that I say, every word that this court says, is broadcast all over the world to anybody with an internet connection. And all they don't have to be a citizen of Georgia. That's a remarkably forward-looking position. And if this court were to dial back from that position by saying, you know, the audio recordings aren't court records in the first place, simply because there's a transcript of them created,
I think you made the answer to that question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I've been kind of kind, but my kindness is over here.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, ladies. Lady. And please be safe going back. Thank you for your argument.
Following oral arguments, I caught up with the Kapp and Cobb team in the hallway and out in the court steps to hear their thoughts on how the oral arguments had gone.
So we just walked out of the Supreme Court of Georgia.
That's right.
Heard two arguments, including ours, and it was a pretty lively argument.
I would say that was a hot bench.
Yeah, that was definitely a hot bench.
Yeah, they had a lot of feelings.
Yeah, they had some very strong feelings.
You know, it's hard to predict sometimes.
I forgot today we had something else going on. Claire Gilbert got admitted to the State Bar.
She did indeed. Very nice day for Claire.
Yeah, 2-1-1 for her down at the courthouse.
And I believe we had some exonerees in the courtroom.
Yes, we did. I know we had Justin Chapman and a few others.
Yeah.
Who I'll try and talk to before we get done here.
Yeah,
so what do you think about the arguments?
They're always fascinating. You know, I find with this court in particular, they tend to be hard on both sides, so sometimes it can be difficult to predict what's going to happen from that. But they've clearly dug into the issues and have really thought about it. So
yeah, they clearly were prepared. They definitely cared about this issue.
Yeah. Which is good. It deserves a lot of thought.
It does. I thought the... comment from. How'd it go? How do you feel?
You know, when I'm arguing, I'm like in a blur. I'm in a haze, so I have no idea. But so far, people are saying they think it went pretty well. I think ours went better than the government's. It's hard to use that as a basis for figuring out if we're going to win. But if I'm going to use that as a basis, then I think our chances are decent.
You never can tell. You can always have an opponent that's got nothing, and the court still wants to rule how it's rule. But I have never actually heard like a prolonged awkward silence in an oral argument.
I haven't either.
That was a first for me.
I thought it was an excellent argument. I thought that the justices were quite prepared. They've clearly been thinking through these issues, particularly the questioning from Justice Namias and Justice Peterson shows that they were both focusing on the issue of court records and also of the proper procedure. I also thought that the questioning on how a audio recording of the court, which is unquestionably a court record at the time of the recording, could lose its status as a court record when a transcript was prepared was particularly a keen observation by the court, because there really doesn't make any sense to strip a record of its status as a public record because of the creation of a second record, yeah, which is potentially a less accurate record.
And it removes privacy concerns because everyone knows it might be a court record for a period of time.
Exactly.
They're going to kill me now. James Cobb, if we win, big if, I think the moment that we won was when he conceded they were, that oral recordings were court records until a transcript was made. That seemed pretty big.
That's exactly right, because after that happened, Justice Grant, she jumped on him and said, well, what about the creation of a transcript could somehow remove its status as a court record? And we had addressed that point in our brief, mm-hmm, in a footnote, where we acknowledged that there was a transcript created here, but that should have no effect on whether it's a court record. We also acknowledge that that might have an effect on the second step of this analysis, because perhaps you don't have to meet as high an evidentiary burden to overcome the presumption of access, but I think they were all over that.
How can it be a court record at one point and then not another?
You know, what's interesting, that actually is the rule in the Second Circuit.
Oh, really?
There are two courts, but the Second Circuit uses the sliding scale type, mm-hmm, test that measures whether something is a court record based on its relevance and usability. Relevance to the judicial process and usability for judges.
So it's a grayscale.
It is a grayscale, and they also have acknowledged that in certain circumstances something can start off as a court record and then become not a court record. And my goal on rebuttal, I didn't end up doing this because Benham asked me a question that was, yeah, a softball that I wanted to take advantage of, but my goal getting up was to make clear that all of these concerns the state's raising can all be addressed at the second step of the analysis, but that step never occurred here because the state didn't participate. Because
the state couldn't have any argument. They didn't have anything to make.
Now we know why they defaulted on that motion, because they had nothing to say about why these tapes shouldn't be released.
I'm surprised they couldn't find some bullshit to make up, though. So here's a question. Is that at all binding on them? Are they allowed to represent before the...
You can't... So there's a concept in Georgia law, judicial admission. It's not unique to Georgia. But there is law in Georgia that it's almost impossible to hold the state to a judicial admission. So taking a position in one case doesn't necessarily bind them in another case.
Even with the same case?
So that's a different issue. Georgia has abolished the law of the case doctrine by statute. So, yeah, and law of the case... which gives us freedom as lawyers representing parties. We can shift positions, but you have a credibility,
yeah,
if you do that.
Yeah.
Especially when you're fighting about something like this that is so public policy in its foundation.
Yeah. You know?
James Cobb did a fantastic job arguing our case for the Supreme Court of Georgia. And I'd like to give a huge, huge thanks from everyone on the Undisclosed team to him, Mike Kaplan, Sarah Burton-Palmer, and the whole Kaplan Cobb Law Firm for everything they've done to support both Undisclosed and the open access rights of all Georgians. And now that oral arguments are done, next up comes the hard part, waiting for the court to issue a decision. But based on the judge's questions at oral argument, I've mostly been able to put my biggest fears to rest. I don't think there's a real chance that Undisclosed lawsuit will accidentally be the basis of a judicial decision that removes the right of all Georgians to copy any court records, like I'd feared at times when this started. But for the sake of our listeners and for Joey's sake, I hope we do get access to and a right to copy the trial tapes, whether it be through our motion or through a writ of mandamus, so that that way everyone will be able to hear what happened at Joy's trial back in 2001, and why now, in 2017, the Georgia Innocence Project is seeking to have that conviction overturned.
Undisclosed was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Super producer Methil Telham brought this all together. Our great sponsors this week were Stamps.com, Audible, and Squarespace. Folks, please go check out those products. And when you do, don't forget to use our promo code that you heard in the spot. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please go check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez compose undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com. And Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday, May 22nd, when we return with episode 11 of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Until then.